Coming up, the Pope visits the Middle East as other religious leaders there also search for a way to peace.
About the only thing I know that works, building relationships, praying together, and let the faith aspect take over. It's strong, it's powerful. We never do it.
And concerns that on many U.S. college campuses, dating and courtship have been replaced by hooking up.
What is this teaching them about being in relationship to others?
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome. I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Pope Benedict XVI began his Middle East visit in Jordan, met by its king and queen. He said he hoped the spiritual power of the Catholic Church could help bring about peace between Israelis and Palestinians. Monday, the Pope travels to Israel. We have more on the Pope's visit coming up. Meanwhile, there's a little-known multi-faith initiative also working for Middle East peace, with support from the U.S. government and visiting delegations of American Christians, Muslims, and Jews. They say there can never be peace in the Holy Land without strong relationships between religious leaders. Kim Lawton is in Jerusalem.
Just outside Bethlehem, an American group is touring the Aida Palestinian refugee camp. These are not typical Holy Land pilgrims. It's a delegation of Christian, Muslim, and Jewish leaders who are part of an American faith-based initiative to bolster peace in this land of conflict. Former U.S. Ambassador Tony Hall is heading the initiative along with Cardinal Theodore McCarrick.
I don't think any of us are under any illusions that we're going to solve the peace problem, but we also realize that you can't have peace without religious leaders. And that's why we come here and try to build these relationships.
This is Hall's 13th trip to the region in the last 24 months. He says as a former Democratic congressman and ambassador, he's seen the limits of politics and diplomacy.
I have, you know, voted for war. I voted against war. I have voted for this program or that program. I have spoken against treaties. As an ambassador, I signed treaties. About the only thing I know that works is building relationships, praying together, and let the faith aspect take over. It's strong, it's powerful. We never do it.
For more than 2 years, the U.S. government has supported a dual-pronged approach, bringing interfaith groups of Americans to meet with their counterparts here in the Holy Land and supporting a coalition of top religious leaders here trying to create a climate where peace can take hold.
What you have before you is a council, not only of religious leaders, but of the religious leaders.
The Council of Religious Institutions of the Holy Land was first announced at a Washington News conference in November 2007. Its members include Israel's chief rabbis, the supreme judge of the Palestinian Islamic courts, and the heads of the major Christian denominations in the Holy Land. Rabbi David Rosen of the American Jewish Committee in Israel is also part of the council.
Never in the history of the Holy Land did there ever exist a body of the leadership of the three faiths of this land. I mean, it's both wonderful and pathetic. It's pathetic that this has never happened before. It's wonderful that despite everything, we're managing to keep it going.
The council has established a rapid communication hotline to address protection of holy sites and to respond to derogatory portrayals of other faiths in the media or within religious communities. Now the council is launching a project to monitor school textbooks. According to council member and Lutheran Bishop Munib Younan, that project is much needed.
We are working now on monitoring the textbooks both in Israel and Palestine, and to see, you see, what do we teach about the other, because usually what we teach about the other is very shameful.
Still, politics all too often interferes. Tensions have been particularly high since the recent conflict between Israel and Gaza.
While most Christian denominations can be said to be independent, Jewish and Muslim religious representatives are subject to, if not subjugated by, the political authorities. So when things are tough politically, it tends to be much more difficult for them to be at the table. And yet, notwithstanding all those pressures, we still manage to weather the storms.
We have the suffering of our people under our skin. So when we sit, we speak on reality. So this is the reason sometimes it's difficult.
Hall brings interfaith delegations from the U.S. to encourage council members and to meet with other local Muslim, Christian, and Jewish groups across the spectrum.
I would be happy to create a debate with you. It's not a problem.
I'm not debating. I'm asking no questions.
The deliberately interfaith nature of the group can be challenging, especially when people confront viewpoints different from their own. Suhail Khan is an American Muslim with the Institute for Global Engagement.
You definitely feel that there are different narratives, and you feel different people within the group sometimes bristling at what they're hearing, sometimes not willing to accept whatever narrative they might be hearing at the time. And so that has been a challenge. But I'm finding that it's helping us really come together.
For me, it's important that they see reality and see the complexity of the reality in which we are living as in this part of the world, to hear both sides, both fears, both worries, but at the same time, not to abide in the fears and the worry, to give us a sign of hope.
Several delegation members say they're returning to the U.S. with a new sense of responsibility for getting involved in the peace process.
I mean, the power of bringing Christians and Muslims and Jews together, it's stunningly powerful. And if we could bring the real masses of our faith and the real elites of our faith and get them deeply engaged, and something has to be done here, I think we've done something good.
The initiative began under the Bush administration, but leaders on both sides of the ocean hope President Obama will continue the program and perhaps even expand it.
So I'm hoping that this new administration, especially with the contacts we have, thanks to our friends in the United States who have been so supportive of the work that we do, that we can be perceived as a stakeholder and a strategic asset on the part of this administration in its new initiatives.
There are also questions about how supportive Israel's new political leadership may be.
I wouldn't automatically assume that the fact that it is more right-wing and less inclined to make political concessions means that it's going to be less understanding of the religious dimension.
Ambassador Hall admits the task can seem daunting.
It's tough. This is a tough country. It's a tough holy land. Everybody talks about peace, but it's peace talking, not peace making. So I think it's a matter of building relationships. It's a matter of coming back. It's a matter of doing it drip by drip.
And as people of faith, they say they won't give up.
I think when one brings God into the equation, when one brings our highest selves, our spiritual selves into the decision making, I think that that hope always springs, that hope is always there.
Kim Lawton joins us now from Jerusalem. Kim, it seems from here that this is an unusually difficult time for peacemaking there. What's your sense of what Pope Benedict can accomplish?
Well, certainly the tensions from the conflict over Gaza in recent months are still very much a part of the mix here. Pope Benedict has said that this is not a political mission, but a spiritual pilgrimage. But of course, there is a strong political overtone to everything he says and does. He has spoken very frequently about his concern about the conflict here. He cares very much about Middle East peace. He will be meeting with political leaders, and people are hoping that he can use that sort of moral bully pulpit that he has to indeed have an influence.
In recent years, the Pope has said some things and done some things that have offended both Muslims and Jews. So there's some fence mending to be done, too, isn't there?
Indeed, he really has some multi-faith challenges before him. He will be visiting some mosques in Jordan and here in Israel. He'll be the first pope to actually visit the Dome of the Rock, which is so important to Muslims, one of their holiest sites. He's hoping that symbolism of going to those places will help counteract some of the negative publicity he got after he made a speech where he quoted a Byzantine emperor who had some not very nice things to say about the Prophet Muhammad. But he's hoping that the visual impact of this trip will help. The same thing with the Jewish community. There have been some concerns after the Pope lifted the excommunication of a bishop who denied the Holocaust and some other issues. The Vatican has been working hard behind the scenes to repair those relationships. And so now, again, they hope that there's a really public visual indication that the Pope does care about the Muslim people and the Jewish people.
Kim, when the Pope and other religious leaders speak about bringing spiritual power to bear on complex political issues, how do they think that can work?
Well, for them, as people of faith, the biggest power is indeed spiritual power. And so I think that's what they're hoping they can draw upon to really make a difference here. You know, when I spoke with Ambassador Tony Hall about his effort, he said, we've tried everything else and nothing else has worked, so why not do that? Especially in this place, which is so holy to the three major religions of the world. Religion is so tied into the politics that it's hard to separate it out. And I think the Pope and a lot of the other religious leaders that I've been talking to really believe that in order for peace to firmly take hold, you have to have the religious community on board and you have to harness some of that spiritual power.
Kim Lawton, many thanks. There's much more from Kim on our website. Ever since the presidency of Harry Truman, the first Thursday of May has been called the National Day of Prayer. Under President George W. Bush, the observances included a worship service at the White House of mostly Republican evangelical Christians. This year, President Obama signed a prayer proclamation, as has been customary, but he chose not to hold a White House service. His press secretary said prayer is something the president does every day. An American freelance journalist imprisoned in Iran has ended her hunger strike. 32-year-old Roxana Saberi ended the strike after 2 weeks for health reasons, according to her father. Last month, she began serving an 8-year prison sentence on charges of spying for the U.S. Saberi had vowed to continue the hunger strike until she was released. Her case is to be reviewed by an Iranian appeals court. Saberi is a graduate of Concordia College, a Lutheran school in Minnesota. Lutheran and other religious leaders have called for her release. Global financial woes could push the number of people suffering from hunger to record levels. As many as 1 billion people could go hungry by the end of the year, according to the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. The group says the current financial crisis has led to a decrease in trade and development aid. They say this year alone, the number of people going hungry will likely increase by 104 million. Maine is now the fifth state to allow same-sex marriages. But on the same day the bill cleared the legislature and the governor's desk, opponents launched a legal challenge. They want to overturn the new law through a referendum. It would take place no earlier than November, but first opponents need to gather about 55,000 voter signatures. In New Hampshire, a bill legalizing gay marriage has already passed the legislature. Now its fate rests with the governor. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., interfaith leaders from around the country lobbied for hate crimes legislation and laws to protect gays from job discrimination. During the two-day clergy call 2009, the first openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church called religion the greatest obstacle to equality for lesbians and gays.
We are actually witnessing the church impinging on the state. We are seeing religious people trying to enforce their views, values, and beliefs on a secular culture.
Now, the concerns among observers and some participants about the phenomenon of hooking up on many college campuses. You may think this is no one else's business, but writers and sociologists who've studied what's happening say casual hookups can make it more difficult for young people to develop long-term commitments. Judy Valente reports.
A basement bar near the campus of a major Eastern university, Thursday night, around 10 p.m. Some of these young people, after having a few drinks, or more than a few, may later become physically intimate in some way, possibly with someone they barely know. It's called hooking up, and it's not uncommon behavior these days.
A lot of universities at 5:30, almost every adult has left the campus. I mean, literally, it's a small village that's taken over by 18 to 22-year-olds, and so what they want to do, they do.
I think it exists on every college campus. I think this is how students develop relationships with one another on college campuses nationwide.
Hardly any of our friends are in a serious relationship. Most people have, you know, steady hookups, but they would never consider them their boyfriend or their girlfriend.
Most guys love to go looking out for the hookup. I think it's a lot better than having a relationship, personally.
Why?
Because there's more excitement. I mean, you don't really have the monotony of just going out to dinner with the same girl or just hanging out with her every single night.
Hooking up can mean anything from kissing to sexual intercourse or something in between. It comes with no emotional involvement and certainly no commitment. In other words, no strings attached.
I would say the hookup culture is very pervasive. Most young people have to deal with it. It's around them. Even if they never hook up, even if they think it's immoral, they have friends that are, or they know people that are.
Christian Smith is a sociologist at the University of Notre Dame. He's been studying the emotional and spiritual development of young people from their early teenage years to college age and beyond.
The intimacies of physical involvement and sexual involvement among college-age students these days, they don't know what it means. They don't expect much from it. It doesn't have much significance. It seems to be another form of entertainment that doesn't have too much attached to it.
Whatever happened to dating? To romance? Why is there what some have called a crisis of courtship?
My mom is always like, Sarah, you know, I can't believe you don't have a boyfriend. You know, college is the time where you can meet your, like, potential husband. But in fact, really, like, not a lot of, like, dating, traditional courting goes on. I went to an all-girls school for 13 years. I thought coming here, you know, you meet a lot of guys and hopefully you would leave with having a boyfriend. But now I think that after being here for 2 years, I think that it's more about, you know, just meeting random people and having fun.
The media has just been more explicit about sex and casual relationships, Sex in the City, whatever it might be. Young people have just picked up. This is just a normal part of life. It's no big deal. You just, if somebody's attractive to you, anything's fair game as long as both people are consenting.
Laura Sessions Stepp is a journalist who has written about how hooking up impacts the young women who are involved in it and why they do it in the first place.
There are several factors. One is the empowerment of women. Women feeling like they can do anything a man can do. We've seen that in business, and now we see it in their social lives. Their parents have told them relationships can wait. They're hard. You get emotionally involved with someone that distracts you from your studies. Put that aside. Go for your career.
Why would a young woman engage in this behavior?
If you ask them, they would say it's fun. They would say it's pleasurable for a time. I think beneath that, there are deeper levels of wanting to be accepted.
Hookups often follow heavy drinking. Laura Sessions Stepp got this letter from a young man who had read her book.
An often occurring event, at least to me, is a drunk girl throwing herself all over me and frequently asking me to take her home or similar. I have found that girls are offended if I do not sleep with them, which is usually the first night I meet them.
The prevalence of the hookup culture may come as news to many people, but is it seriously harming those who participate in it, or is it just another generation sowing its wild oats?
Donna Freitas, now an assistant professor of religion at Boston University, has written about the spiritual and sexual lives of college students.
To have a successful hookup, you're able to shut yourself down emotionally, so you do not care when you physically engage with someone in some way. You basically don't care about it the next day. So that's a successful hookup.
The point is not that they're having sex. Young people have always had sex. Certainly my generation did. Outside of marriage. That's not the point. The point is the relationship. What is this teaching them about being in relationship to others?
I think this is a stage in our lives, just a college stage, but hopefully we'll mature.
Yeah, I'm just looking at it fun. You know, no regrets.
Young people today draw a very strong line between their fun years and their settling down years. What happened in my early to mid-20s will stay there, and then I will magically become a happy, faithful, committed, monogamous person, and what happened in 3 years ago won't affect my life in the future. I personally think that that's quite naive.
One hookup, depending on the scenario, depending on where it happens, depending on who finds out, depending on who it's with and what they say afterwards or who watches it happen, can make or break your college experience. I heard that over and over again, and think about that. One night could make or break your college experience.
But social psychologist Pepper Schwartz, who studied the sexual behavior of students at 11 U.S. campuses, says hooking up doesn't necessarily cause emotional damage.
I think that when we say that people are hurt from hookups, compare that to a situation where every relationship has to be important. He's the love of your life, or vice versa. It breaks up. They get suicidal. They feel terrible about it. That's a really terrible thing when you're talking about adolescents and people just maturing. Is it a hookup by its nature hasn't proceeded to an extremely important emotional connection. When it's over, you know, so be it.
But is it really?
Well, you know what, with the hookup, someone's always going to get attached, and so that leads to a little bit of heartbreak for one side. For me, personally, I try not to get too attached at all.
When people are physically intimate, that's powerful. That affects their emotions in ways they may not be able to control. It has impacts on their relationships.
People go on, usually in their early 20s to mid-20s, and just say, enough of that, I'm going to go and look for something more important. But it's not like they're damaged forever. They do, in fact, make relationships, and they get tired of this. It's not like they are now doomed to always have sterile, passing by sexual relationships that mean nothing.
A woman in her 30s, describing herself as scarred by her sexual experiences, wrote this letter.
I think our culture has no idea just what we women feel inside. We put this pressure on them and let them turn from girls to women without any help. It is too much what we do to our daughters.
What about religion's role? Do its teachings about individual dignity affect sexual behavior? Donna Freitas found that hooking up is just as common at Catholic universities as at secular schools, but much less so at evangelical schools. Christian Smith says a religious upbringing may deter hooking up, but not always.
There are a lot of young people who just compartmentalize. They completely compartmentalize, that meaning my religious faith is something over there, and how I behave at parties and in my dorm room is just unrelated.
One reason hooking up is as prevalent as it is that on many campuses, administrators long ago gave up seeing themselves as substitute parents or moral police. Lori White is Vice President for Student Affairs at Southern Methodist University in Dallas.
At the end of the day, each individual is responsible for the decisions that he or she makes. And we're very clear with that when we have initial conversations with students during orientation. So I don't see myself in any way as a parental figure. I see myself as an educator and helping students through this next phase of their life. I'm just not quite sure where it's going to go from here. You know, it may well be that we have a counter-revolution, that we get so far out there that people begin to really feel uncomfortable with that and decide that we have really gone too far and that we need to really get back to some of the core values of our grandparents' generations.
There are hints of reaction. Donna Freitas says students in her study would claim at first that they liked hooking up, only to admit later on that they wish things were different. And it wasn't just the women.
Probably one of the most surprising findings I got from the study was that men do not like cultures of casual sex, men do not like hookup culture, and men really love romance but don't know how to sort of get themselves in situations where it's okay to be romantic.
We don't talk enough about love in this society. It has somehow become a word that people are afraid to use. But in essence, that's what every one of those young women that I talked to and have written me want, and the young men as well. They want to be loved and to love. And the question they have to ask themselves is hooking up the way to get there?
College administrators say parents should not assume it's too late to talk with their children about sex and relationships, even when they're in college. And more colleges are engaging in dialogue with students about hooking up. But ultimately, it will have to be the students themselves who decide whether there might be a better way. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Judy Valente in Washington.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. There's much more on our website. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. And there's good news about our website. It has won this year's People's Voice Webby Award in Religion and Spirituality from the International Academy of Digital Arts and Sciences. Our thanks to all who supported us. As we leave you, more scenes from Pope Benedict XVI's arrival Friday in Jordan.